John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Well, according to my guest this hour, virtually every American on one level or another falls victim to the hype, intensity, and propaganda that accompany political panic. Well, just what is it about us as a nation that causes us to overreact so often? That's one of the things we'll be talking about this hour with Mark Stein, New York Times bestselling author of How the States Got Their Shapes, which was the basis of a History Channel series of the same name. His new book is American Panic, The History of Who Scares Us and Why. Mark Stein, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Okay, well, we did have Mark, I promise. I heard him myself, and now we seem to not have him. While we work out those things in the background, let me tell you a little bit more about Mark Stein, and who is, as we mentioned, the author of How the States Got Their Shapes, which was a New York Times bestseller, became the basis of a History Channel series by the same name. He is also a screenwriter. He wrote the screenplay for the film House Sitter, which starred Steve Martin and Goldie Hawn, and did screenplays for various movies of the week for CBS and NBC. He has also been very active as a playwright whose plays have been produced off-Broadway. And he's also a teacher and has taught at Catholic University and American University. His new book, as I mentioned, is American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. We certainly have a long history of political panic in the United States, going all the way back to the Salem witch trials and probably before that. That one was on perhaps a little smaller scale. I'll just toss this out to our listeners and ask you if you can hear, if you can think of some instances of political panic that you recall most vividly. I think in the last 50 years, we probably can name a bunch of them. The fear over communism, that was a great panic that we had in the late 40s and in the 50s and into the 60s. Homosexuality was another panic. There have been panics about things like immigration and panics involving, a little bit longer ago, panics involving the Catholic Church and Freemasonry. All sorts of things have caused us to go into an absolute panic here in America, and there has certainly been fallout from that. But if you can, if you want to call in with your views on what caused some of these and why we tend to overreact to change here in the United States, we'll talk about that during the hour. I expect that we will eventually get Mark Stein connected and be ready to go with the rest of the program. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. It's a different number from the one you normally use to call the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Okay.
800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Again, we're talking about political panic, which may be akin to the panic that talk show hosts go through when their guests are technically unavailable. We'll see. We just heard a brief burst of Mark. We know he's there somewhere, and we're trying to sort out all the technological gremlins before we overreact. Okay. Well, let's go to our guest on line one. We have him connected by phone. Mark, can you hear me?
I do.
Okay. Sorry about all these technical issues. You know, when we try to get creative on the technical side, we can almost always expect something to go very badly wrong, at least.
Well, you know, you have to bear in mind, I'm in Washington, D.C., so I think we can blame this on the NSA.
You know, it's President Obama's fault.
Thanks, Obama, you know.
Yes, yeah, another one. You know, here we go. And all irony intended.
Yeah.
Well, I have to put that out there because some people don't quite get my ironic worldview. So let's start by talking about let's define the term panic as you're using it. What qualifies something as a panic? Are there specific elements that need to be present to qualify some trend or political event as a panic?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think the answer is yes. What there isn't in my book is a bright, shiny line of saying this is panic, this isn't. On the one hand, I talk a lot about the portal to panic. But to your question, is there something that element where you go, look, that's panic? In my book, what I say is when we do that which we fear or say that which we fear, clearly that's panic. so that when, for instance, times not that far in the past, people would say or write of African-American men that they are savage, violent, vicious, sexually, on and on, and then to strengthen the nation from this fear, they would destroy due process of law and lynch, castrate, burn these men. In other words, do all kinds of exactly the things they expressed fear of, savage, brutal, vicious, on and on and on. That's panic. And there is examples of that all the way back to the Salem witch hunt, where there's a really almost comical example of a woman engaging in witchcraft, in effect, to fight witchcraft. That's what I view as clearly delineating panic.
The common denominator here is fear. I mean, we're afraid of a lot of stuff, and it seems to me that as I've read not just this book but others that have dealt with some of the psychology of panic, when certain things tend to completely bypass the rational portion of our brain and go right to what Terry Pratchett calls monkey brain. that part of us that says, something in this tree wants to eat me, I'd better run. And that seems to be the common thread here, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And, of course, we need fear, just to survive. Fear is an essential element. One of the recurring elements that comes up in the book that I think really speaks to what you're saying there about, the monkey brain part, is very often alarmists will use statistics, and particularly correlations. It dates back this particular element to mid-19th century, where they'll correlate, certain acts or behaviors and find that a certain group correlates more highly. And the problem with that, but the way this gets to that, if you will, monkey brain, that middle of our brain, is equating logically, and what one is taught in Statistics 101 is correlation does not imply causation. In other words, it's an amazing fact, but 99% of all murderers drank milk as children. But that isn't what caused them to be murderers. But here's the thing. Correlation does cause assumption. Our life experiences, what we read, things like that. And we need assumptions just to walk down the sidewalk. If we didn't make assumptions, we'd walk down the sidewalk the same way we cross a creek on wet rocks. Now, that's a very benign example of what we do based on correlations, life experiences, and things like that. It becomes anything but benign if we're walking down that sidewalk at night and three young black men are walking toward us. And then how do we correlate? And what assumptions do we make? And, of course, some make some assumptions, some make others. One of the things that I try to get at in the book after identifying a lot of the recurring elements is to say, so what is it about these elements that tells us something about why some people freak out over some political issue and others don't, which, by the way, crosses the political spectrum. It's not the province of conservatives any more than the province of liberals.
So what is it that makes some of us freak out more often? I mean, what are some of the things? Some people just seem to be wired into seeing bad things everywhere they look. There's a bogeyman in every dark corner, behind the door, under the bed, in the closet, in the dishwasher, wherever, and they're all linked in the same worldwide conspiracy. Okay, we know that there are people like that, and we tend to make a little bit we tend to have a little fun with them from time to time.
Yeah.
But there is there's probably a less extreme form of this that can really feed on the kind of fear that you're talking about here, isn't there?
Yeah. Of course, there are what we would call the wing nuts. But indeed, there's a large groups that have in our history that have been where there's been widespread panic and tremendous violence and death and so forth that's been in its wake. And I think without at the moment, anyway, going into all the different recurring elements that the book talks about, do you see it here, do you see it there, do you see it there, what they contribute to is a sense of certitude, what you're asking, what is the thing? It's a need for certitude, and we all need a degree of certitude, but some of us need it more than others, and probably for as many reasons as there are people. I liken it often to jealousy, which has nothing to do with politics, but does have to do with certitude in a relationship. And for any number of reasons where if you can climb into a person's head and their individual wiring, some people have a greater, are more jealous than others. They have a greater need for certitude in a relationship. What my book does try to climb into people's heads to that extent. That's an impossible task, but it does try to show what these recurring elements are, most of them verbal, but not all of them, and how they feed certitude, and therefore people who are particularly needy of certitude, they can be panic-inducing elements so that we just to kind of recognize a little more when we hear them. Oh, I see what that turn of phrase did, you know, or that image, or
cartoon did. We want certainty. We want an explanation for why certain things happen, and there's always that doubt, that suspicion that we aren't always told everything that goes on. There are secrets that we don't know about, and all of a sudden someone comes up and says, "Yes, they aren't telling you everything, and here's why," and we can blame those people over there.
Yeah, secrets are really potent, whether they're intended to be potent and panic-inducing or not. They're part of what I call blanks to be filled in, where a phrase or the very fact that something is secret leaves it to us to determine what is that thing. And in filling that blank, it's inevitable. I mean, we're all subject to this. This isn't like, you know, everyone but me or everyone but people in the state of Wisconsin, obviously, would be excluded in my view. And I jest, in case anyone wonders, to fill in our fears and needs participate in filling that blank. So, you know, with the NSA currently, some people are much more upset over that than others. None of us know how to fill in the blank, how much are they watching us. But to the extent that people are more worried, I think it's their fears and needs, their individual fears and needs, and their need for certitude. By the way, not to say they're wrong, because we don't know yet what the answer is on something like NSA and what they're up to.
Well, it kind of goes back to that old saying, even paranoids have enemies.
That's right. That's right. Does it? Right. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean someone isn't following you.
Right. Yeah. Okay. 800-642-1234. We have some callers wanting to join us. Let's get one in right now. We'll start with Sheree in Waupun. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, hello. Thank you for having me. One thing that I thought maybe would qualify as a panic would be the buying up of guns in America. Like all of a sudden when Barack Obama became elected, all the guns and bullets started disappearing, even though he literally never said one word about gun control during his presidency until the Newtown shooting. But yet you still couldn't get bullets. You still couldn't get certain types of guns. And they were all being bought up for no reason.
Absolutely, Sheree. That's a great example of people panicking based on assumptions that Barack Obama is going to somehow make guns and bullets unavailable, which, given the tenor of the Congress, is kind of, you know, to many of us, hard to accept that fact, but to others, they're absolutely certain that's around the corner. Yeah, and to the point that, yeah, you're right, absolutely changed the marketplace where it became very hard to obtain these things.
Sheree, thanks so much for that call. 800-642-1234, plenty of room for you to get in on our conversation. We're talking about the book, American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. Mark Stein is the author of that book, and he's my guest through this hour. You can join us as well. talk@WPR.org is the email address, talk@WPR.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there, and we'll share it on the radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show this week. And this hour, we're talking about American Panic, a history of who scares us and why. Mark Stein is the author of that book, as well as the author of the New York Times bestseller, How the States Got Their Shapes, which eventually became a television program on the History Channel. So, Mark Stein, you've drawn a lot of connections between various types of panics in the United States. And we've talked about fear being the common element where you can make someone afraid of something and then provide them with a reason why they should be afraid and tell them who to blame for being afraid. You can pretty much have your way with a lot of folks. And we all seem to fall prey to this one way or another. But there have been some panics have been about groups of people ethnically, immigrants in one way or another. It used to be the Irish. It's been the Jews. It's been Mexicans. It's been all sorts of individual groups. But it's also been religion has been involved in a number of panics. You talk a little bit about the various panics relating to the Catholic Church in the United States, for example. Talk about that for a little bit and how these groups of religious people can be subject to these panics.
Yeah, the Catholic Church in particular, today we see it somewhat being reprised in fear of Islam as a religion. But back at the founding of the nation, there was the beginnings of a very long panic over Catholics that really didn't end as a widespread concern until the election of John Kennedy. John Kennedy had to give a speech, a major speech, when he ran for president, assuring people he would not take orders from the Pope. And therein the fear that the Vatican could be calling the shots in this country if too many of our people, our citizens, were Catholics. A couple of things about that are fascinating. Oftentimes we think that panic comes from economic difficulties, or things like that can generate panic, and it does, or can. But, panic can also come from economic success. And in the case of Catholics, two big economic successes really fed that panic. The first was we won the Revolution. And in winning the Revolution and establishing the Constitution, Bill of Rights, there was this fear, as I just mentioned, that, what if we get a lot of Catholics in this country? The Vatican may rule the country. Of the 13 states, the first 13 states, five of them in their original state constitutions prohibited anyone other than a Protestant from holding elective office. So right from the get-go, there was this fear pretty much limited to the fear of Catholics. It got revitalized even more after the Louisiana Purchase, another great American success. We acquired all this land. But as people started to move out there, and in particular before where was public education, which took a long time before that was in place, one of the efforts to educate the children of the pioneers came from the Jesuits. And that generated huge fears that the Jesuits were kind of these secret agents of the Vatican to take this big part of the new nation and put it under the control of the Catholic Church. There was a sermon given in 1834 by a prominent minister named Lyman Beecher, father of Harriet Beecher Stowe. This is not a kook, Lyman Beecher. And he talked about the Catholic Church not only as averse to liberty, but he used any number of absolutes, and the element I really want to talk about from this sermon he gave was he used one of these blanks to be filled in that we were talking about just before the break, where he said that if this nation is to lead the world in morals and so forth, then we must be cut out for the work. That's the part that's a quote, cut out for the work. Well, what constitutes the work? It was up to the listeners to determine what constitutes the work. Within days of that sermon, the Ursuline Convent across the Charles River in what is now Somerville, Massachusetts, was burned to the ground. Any number of churches and some convents were burned. There were beatings when the Irish came in large numbers after the potato famine, but there was partly economic but partly religious reasons. often riots. And I was amazed because I didn't realize how much death, actually, murder was attached to fear of Catholics in the 19th century.
Well, here's an example, though, of where some of that fear may have had at its source at least a modicum of truth, because the Catholic Church had been involved in a lot of European political intrigue, and they certainly were well represented in the New World by the Spanish Empire, and there was a lot of conflict between the Spanish and the English, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there was that fear came from Europe over to America with the people who came here, and
yeah.
And so, I mean, there was at its basis maybe. You know, yeah, there really is something to worry about, because look at what's been happening in Europe for the last several hundred years with the Catholic Church and in the post-Reformation era and so forth. And so, you know, once in a while you get that. But it seems like the other thing that plays into this, and I'd like you to comment on this, is people's ignorance,
mm-hmm.
the lack of knowledge, creating even more fear and more uncertainty.
Well, yeah, actually you raised two really good points. First of all, you're absolutely correct that there was some reason to think this could be the case. And one of the recurring elements, ironically, that I talk about is that oftentimes someone will, an alarmist will gain traction by building on a foundation that has some truth to it, and then build on that with half-truths, if you will, or unverified facts or absolutes or these other things, and as you say, there was an element of truth to the Catholic Church being a political entity in Europe, although never before was it an entity in trying to control a democracy. Those were monarchies, and so here's where an absolute kicked in. The absolute was that in this country, as a democracy, to have that fear, you have to then accept this absolute that all Catholics think and act alike, because those are the voters. And that's where that begins to start moving toward the realm of panic, thinking that all Catholics think and act alike. And I have forgotten your second part of your question.
Well, and I've forgotten it as well, so let's move on.
Ignorance.
Oh, yeah, ignorance. The role that ignorance plays in all of this.
Yeah, playing an element right now in my response, I guess. One of the other things that I expected when I set out to write the book and found absolutely false, I expected to find that that people who get so alarmed, so panicked, tend to be less educated. I don't know that there's statistics. I don't know how you'd make such a metric. But so many people, I have examples of in the book, who are highly educated people, many of them really highly respected, have expressed panic thoughts. I won't say they were, you know, all the way in the realm, but panic thoughts about this or that group of people or capitalists or communists or something, that I don't. I think it's a behavioral piece that isn't connected to one's educational level necessarily. I think it's mm-hmm. connected to deeper things in one's psyche.
Well, there were some pretty big intellectuals involved in the whole Red Scare thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And by the way, just to kind of come full circle between the Red Scare and Catholics, one of the questions I wondered about is what causes a panic to end? And two things, but both actually pertaining to Catholics in America, that I have found repeatedly will help dissipate a panic over a group is instances where that group dies side by side with other Americans in war, and Catholics certainly did that in every war since they've been in this country. And the one other element with Catholics was, and this is quite ironic, during the Red Scare, some of the leading anti-communist, Joe McCarthy, Senator McCarran, his first name escapes me, Pat McCarran, were Catholics. Catholics were among the leading anti-communists, maybe not so fondly remembered as individuals today, but in fact that dampened fear that Catholics were somehow less American than the rest of us.
Speaking of religion, and you alluded to this when we started to talk about the panic connected to Catholics, what about the current panic related to Islam? What are the similarities between that and the panics related to Catholicism? And might we find then at some point the same solution to that panic?
I think so. The fear that the Pope would call the shots was sort of the fear that we would have Catholicism imposed on us. I think it was trying to find, actually have the quote here somewhere from Newt Gingrich and others that Sharia law, that there is a fear of Sharia law that would be imposed on us by stealth jihadists. Here it is. This was Newt Gingrich, said, "I believe Sharia is a mortal threat to the survival of freedom." So there's an absolute mortal threat to the survival of freedom in the United States. Here comes a blank to be filled in. He goes on to say, "Stealth jihadists use political, cultural, societal, religious, and intellectual tools." Stealth jihadists, who are these stealth jihadists in our political, cultural, societal, religious, intellectual life? Is Fareed Zakaria a stealth jihadist that we don't recognize? Not very similar to the kinds of things that were said about the Jesuits, in effect.
And that's just it, isn't it? I mean, if they're stealth, we can't really see them, and so we don't know exactly where they are. And so that suggests, doesn't it, that we have to go look for them and root them out wherever we find them?
That's right. That's right. If one has such a need for certitude and fear about this country being vulnerable to that, it absolutely plays into those fears for those people. By the way, something else that plays in that you mentioned just a moment ago is ignorance, or playing off the ignorance of a great number of the people who might hear this, because I truly don't think Newt Gingrich is an ignorant man, and I think he is very knowledgeable about the Constitution, and therefore he would know that Sharia law is not a threat because of what's called the Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says that no law can be supreme to the law of the United States. So by definition, we can't have Sharia law. We only have laws passed by our legislature and by our Congress, and he knows that. Mm-hmm. But he's availing himself of panic, which is another big piece of this. Just because an alarmist is expressing panic doesn't mean the alarmist is panic. Often they're availing themselves of panic to further their own agenda.
Let's take some more phone calls. Sure. Andy in Oshkosh, you'll be next. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Hi there. I just want to share one of my stories I had as a kid and then ask a quick question to your guest. As I was growing up, the threat of anthrax, I guess when I was a 10-year-old, I'd be checking my birthday cards that I got from family members for white powder, which is, I guess, a little odd, but I guess my question is my younger generation and the generations to come, is this fear being, like, overcompensated with our television news that we have going on now? I mean, compared to earlier news programs and how they portrayed news.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the sensationalism of the 24-hour news cycle, Andy?
Yes. And I wonder, is that playing a part in this growth of fear in especially younger generations? And is that something that will continue to be a trend?
Yeah, I'm really glad, Andy, you asked that question. To answer the second part there, yes. Some of these news media that we have today are purveying fear and creating a great deal more fear and vehemence, I think, or adding to it anyway, availing themselves of it, than in the recent past. But that itself is a recurring element. To me, it's oddly comforting to know that the news media, as we think of it in our day and age, and I'm not real knowledgeable about journalistic history, but I think I'm correct in this, that we tend to think of it as what I call the Edward R. Murrow kind of a style of media news, which is to be as objective as possible in presenting the news. Edward R. Murrow, a great broadcaster from World War II and then the years following, and a whole generation of newscasters who followed in his footsteps. But I'm pretty sure I'm correct in saying that through the history of this country, that was kind of a journalistic blip that, for the most part, starting, well, before the revolution, but starting with this country's early years and coming up into the 20th century and recurring again now, journalism was much more like it is now, where the newspapers were mouthpieces for various constituencies and would inflame public views as much, if not more, than they would inform the public as objectively as possible about things. I'll give one quick example. My wife works at the newspaper and periodical division of the Library of Congress. And when I was researching this book, I said to her, boy, I don't understand the New York Herald. They're like, this is in the 1840s, 1850s, they're like really pro-slavery. It's the New York Herald. What gives? And she says, well, you keep in mind that Wall Street was financing the cotton trade in this country and had all sorts of economic ties and interests in the South, and the New York Herald was the mouthpiece for Wall Street, for its interests. If you want to hear other views from New York, and I actually had found them, you know, other New York papers at the time were espousing different things. So, yes, the media does contribute, but take comfort. They've been doing that for most of our history, and we've muddled through to here, so we're probably okay.
If you wanted to know about that, just Google the term yellow press.
Yes, yes.
And there were multiple editions of newspapers all day long in all of the major metropolitan areas. People read these things from cover to cover. That's where they got their news, other than over the back fence. And you're right, the Edward R. Murrow, the more objective style of journalism, is a much more recent development, the development of those kinds of standards of objectivity, much more recent development in mass communication. And so we're kind of swinging back to what we had maybe 100 years ago or so in the cable and internet news era. And it's not just news outlets, official news outlets anymore, is it, Mark Stein? We also have a lot of other places where people share their conspiracy theories and reinforce one another's beliefs in what's really going on. And if I could, I would have put italics on really. Yeah. What about the role of social media and the internet in feeding some of these panics?
Yeah, you know, remains to be seen, I guess, because to some extent, because it's kind of new. But my guess is that that is more related to what I would call rumor. There's actually a whole body of research psychologists have done on rumor. People, no matter what their views, they want to learn what's really happening, italics or not. And so I think that rumors, while they can be tremendously damaging, they tend to be brief if they're not true. So I think that it's a factor, but I think it tends to be more ephemeral as a factor in panic than more traditional, you know, sources of information.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have full phone banks. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll take calls when we come back. Talking with Mark Stein, New York Times bestselling author of How the States Got Their Shapes, and the author of the book under discussion this hour, American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. 800-642-1234, talk@WPR.org, or find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave a comment there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show this week, talking with Mark Stein, the author of American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. And before we go back to the phones, Mark Stein, I meant to ask this earlier, but our technical issues at the top of the program kind of drove the question right out of my mind, what's left of it. I think I'm left with only the limbic brain. But what was it that put you on to this idea of political panic in the first place? So was there one kind of thing you saw, I wonder why that happened, and you started to do some research? Or what was it that caused you to write this book?
Yes, sir, perhaps. I had done the two states books. I was went up to New York to have lunch with my agent. And he had been asking me for a long time, what's next? I really had nothing. And I had some time to kill, and I thought he's gonna ask again. I gotta give him an idea. So I had some time, and I stopped in a bookstore, and it's so stupid in a way. What just jumped out at me: all these books that were filled with rage over this issue or that. And at lunch, I said, I think I'm kind of interested in rage, and I think it's been around all through the history of the country. I'm kind of interested in looking at that. I wasn't using the word panic yet. And he said, "Oh, I think you're onto something. Take a look into that. Let's stay in touch." And it evolved from that, starting to do kind of scratching the surface on research, looking for recurring elements in first kind of using rage-like terms as a search term, but evolving as it got more and more clear to me into a little more subtle distinction of panic, because what I realized is not all alarm is panic, and not all vehemence, if you will, rage, is necessarily panic. Panic is a certain quality where reason is trampled by passion or fear.
Let's take a call from Fred in Madison, because I think that speaks to the point that you just made, Mark Stein. Fred, go ahead.
Hi, I love this discussion, but I think the guest should face a Pearl Harbor attack and the panic that followed, and the 9/11 attack and the panic that followed. And I think the guest is maybe a little self-deceiving. He sees panic and rage, but he should talk about interest. He should talk about what are the interests of this republic. And in the historical things that I've mentioned, the republic chose to go to war against the enemy. And in Afghanistan and in Iraq, it was murderous. And it was also murderous against Japan and Germany. I think you should answer that. And I say it was panic. Bye.
All right, Fred, thanks. We get the point. Mark Stein, we really are under attack. And those are panics also. Not the same kind, though, that you're talking about in most of this book.
No, but, Fred, you make a bit of an assumption that I don't talk about those things. I haven't talked about them on this show yet, but there's a whole part of the book about the Japanese, particularly with World War II, but even prior to World War II. And a whole chapter on Arabs and Muslims that deals with 9/11. What I am talking about is domestic panic as opposed to foreign wars, although foreign policies can certainly feed a domestic panic.
Well,
let me address about Pearl Harbor, because there's something very interesting that I discovered in researching the response to Pearl Harbor insofar as the internment of Japanese. And that was that within a day, well, it was on December 8th, the day after Pearl Harbor, Attorney General Francis Biddle said to the nation, "Do not panic about the Japanese who are in this country. We are on top of that." And by we, he meant the FBI. And so those who were here who were Japanese nationals, they were going to get sent out. Those who were American citizens who gave the FBI cause for concern would be, and not just Japanese, by the way, also German nationals and German Americans. He made very clear in the statement, "We are on top of this. You need not panic." Within a week or two, panic started spinning regarding Japanese, particularly from very influential and not wacko sources, such as Walter Lippmann writing a column urging the roundup of Japanese Americans. Of course, we rounded up all Japanese Americans in along the West Coast. We interned a much, much smaller number of German Americans. There were some arrests and trials and deportations with German Americans. The bottom line at the end of World War II is, so, since we did this to the Japanese Americans with internment, but we did not intern all German Americans, how many acts of sabotage were committed during the war in this country by Japanese or by Germans? I think I'm correct in saying the answer is something very close to zero. So, in fact, Attorney General Biddle was quite likely quite correct. that the FBI was on top of it, there was not the need for panic that Walter Lippmann and others stirred up.
Well, but that raises another issue that seems to be another thread that runs through these various panics that you describe in your book, and that is the demonization of the other, the enemy, whoever they are, whether it's caricatures of Germans or the Japanese in World War II, of other ethnic groups that we've been afraid of. And by we, I mean the white Protestant population of the United States, for example. And so there's always this element of, in order to enhance the strength of the panic, the people who, if there's somebody trying to cause it, you need to make somebody the demon here.
Yes, and the recurring element that most frequently occurs, if you will, in demonization. And you kind of get right down to the text of, here's a text that's demonizing this group or that. More often than not is the use of an absolute, because you need those absolutes in order to make the case that all Japanese or all Arabs or all this group or that group are this way. It's not only absolutes, but very often that's where you'll start seeing absolutes being used quite a bit.
Let's go to Appleton next, where Steele is waiting to talk with us. Steele, good afternoon.
Hey, hello, everybody. Yes, I was wondering if your guest is familiar with the movie Reefer Madness.
Yes.
Yes, and I just looked on Wikipedia I'm seeing it was originally financed by a church group called Tell Your Children, is our culture is changing, and now it's becoming, it's the big gateway drug, and I don't know how many people are in prison, but I don't know. I just got a kick out of that.
Yeah. In this particular book, I don't deal with as panic over marijuana or panic over drugs. And it actually was just where do I draw the line kind of decision. Because originally I had envisioned a chapter on things like panic over alcohol, panic over the prohibition and so forth, panic over education, which is something we never had until after World War II, when for the first time we achieved, in a sense, great national success. We were the preeminent power in the world, and suddenly we were fearful that our educational system wasn't going to keep us in that place. I think you're quite correct. There's been panic over things like marijuana, alcohol. There's also legitimate concerns too. So I don't mean to do an absolute.
Well, again, it's that small element of truth at the basis of the panic that helps to set it off.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Kind of like a blasting cap.
Yes, very much.
Let's take another call. Lynn in Eau Claire is with us next. Lynn, thanks for being here today.
Good afternoon. I have my question is, why does it seem so easy for some people to get all riled up about things that seem rather ridiculous, like Y2K or the Mayan calendar, or the president taking all of their guns away, and refuse, on the other hand, to embrace the awful notion that global warming might, in fact, be a fact.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have a simple answer for that. There's something about those issues that they do get so riled about. Unfortunately, this will be a little bit of a general answer because you cited a variety of what I think agree. Kind of.
Well, let's
about that. There's something about those issues that touch their fears much more profoundly than something like global warming. And I, in some cases, I think I know why, but not always so sure why Y2K would create so much fear when that came by compared to global warming.
We've got Y2K maybe a little bit more personal because a lot of us had personal computers in our home and we were afraid that they weren't going to work, or we would get on an airplane, which is something we can actually see even though we have no idea how they work. And whereas climate change is something that's a lot harder to get your arms around, it's not something you can really see, and there are a lot of what appear to be contradictory pieces of information floating around out there. Well, it was awfully cold yesterday. What about the whole global warming thing? That can't be true. That kind of thing, where it's a much more abstract problem. Could that be playing into some of this? That things that appear to hit us closer to home and are more concrete are easier to get worked up about than things that are a little more abstract?
I think, John, I think you're right. Actually, now that you say it, I think you're onto it. That
well, maybe I'll write a book then.
Yeah, the more immediate and less abstract, the more certain kinds of people who need that certitude are apt to react.
You talked earlier about one of the things you discovered during the course of writing this book was that intelligence wasn't really a factor in whether we were susceptible to panic or not in the terms that you describe in the book. Were there any other real surprises, you had some assumptions going in? What were the other things that you might have discovered that challenged you a little bit?
Yeah. So that was one. Another was that I wasn't prepared for something I referenced a little earlier, that a national success could create the social landscape for panic out of fear of losing that success. But as you know, it seems like as many panics have been spawned out of fear of losing our that which we've achieved, as opposed to panics that have come out of difficulties. I think one other. It's getting a little more narrow, no, but I didn't. There were certain within certain panics things that I never thought about that. But one way this country, one panic in this country, quite different from how it's played out in other countries, was anti-Semitism. There has been panic over Jews. There's no question about it in the United States. Never as bad as Europe. Never as bad, really, as it's been toward virtually all the other groups, although there's an irony to that, which is all the way back to the founding of the country, George Washington, on three occasions, wrote letters of friendship, if you will, to Jewish communities in different states. After the Revolution, one of the ways I think we wanted to conceive of ourselves as we are not Europe. And as part of that, anti-Semitism, unlike the other panics, Americans tended to view, particularly back in that early era before the big immigrations, as part of the tyrannies of Europe. And we won't do that because that's part of the tyrannies of Europe. Here's the irony. By not being anti-Semitic, to see ourselves as different from Europe, I think it also helped Americans mask from their self-image their panic and mistreatment of African Americans and Native Americans in particular, because we were noble people. We accepted Jews. That whole history of anti-Semitism was called in Europe the Jewish equation, the Jewish question. In America, I call it the Jewish equation because it's been a fascinating equation that I wasn't prepared for.
And what I'm never prepared for is that we've run out of time. So now we have to close our conversation. Mark Stein, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you, John, very much.
Mark Stein is the author of American Panic, A History of Who Scares Us and Why. Coming up tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we'll retrace Pope Francis's Middle East visit and explore what his overtures to both Israelis and Palestinians may mean for the peace talks. This hour of programming was produced by K.P. Whaley, on-air production Michelle Good and Marika Suval. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR.